Welcome to Milkmaids Podcast, the unconventional homesteading podcast. I'm Stephanie from Wyoming.
And I'm Tara from Montana. Join us each week as we take a deep dive into an inclusive homesteading topic from canning, dairy animals, gardening, animal husbandry, and everything in between.
Hey, Tara.
Take two.
At least we didn't get very far into that before we admitted it was a giant disaster.
Well, you know.
It's like I was dropping things. The baby was making all sorts of noises, which I'm positive he's going to continue to do.
Yeah, deal with
this
it.
This is now
everyone will have to deal with it.
A three-host operation.
Our co-host is baby.
We all know about the same amount. So this week we are shouting out Native Seed Search. And this is pulled directly from their website just because they said it better than I could ever paraphrase it. So Native Seed Search is a nonprofit seed conservation organization based in Tucson, Arizona. And their mission is to conserve and promote the arid adapted crop diversity of the Southwest in support of sustainable farming and food security. Native Seed Search seeks to find, protect, and preserve the seeds of the people of the greater Southwest so that these arid adapted crops may benefit all people and nourish a changing world. This whole operation started in 1983, and the founders worked with the, I'm so sorry, I don't know 100% how to pronounce this, Tohono O'odham Nation?
If that's not right, please correct us and we'll make sure to say it correctly on the next podcast.
Yeah. They worked with them in establishing gardens for their sustainable food needs, because over many generations, the forces of colonization and obviously globalization have eroded cultures and economies.
The baby's sucking on his fist.
I just can't. So over many generations, the forces of colonization and later globalization have eroded these cultures and economies that keep these vital foods alive in the landscape.
Yeah.
Which, yeah, happens really all over the nation there, specifically in the Southwest. But anyhow, so this sparked them to want to set out to find endangered traditional seeds from and for the communities of the Southwest. So they have a seed bank, which I think is the coolest thing. We have, what is that one called? The big one, the world one? Svalbard,
right? Yeah, it's like in Antarctica?
No.
Oh, we're on two different ones.
Maybe. Seed vaults. Okay, anyway, seed vaults fascinate me.
Yeah.
So, but they have their own seed bank, and they have nearly 2,000 varieties of crops in there, all that are adapted to these like highly specific arid landscapes, extending from southern Colorado to central Mexico, and many of these are rare and endangered. The collection represents the cultural heritage and farming knowledge from over 50 indigenous communities, as well as more recent immigrants like Spanish missionaries and Mormon homesteaders. And they also conserve a number of wild the wild relatives to these crops.
Okay.
Which are like, yeah, just the wild ancestors to domestic plants, because all of our domestic plants started somewhere.
Yeah. Have you ever seen corn in its like very premature?
I don't think I have.
Stages. Like,
is it like three
early
grains?
Ancestors. Yeah. It's like three grains of kernels of corn.
Right.
Right.
Gosh. So currently they offer 500 of those varieties from their collection, alongside with a bunch of native fine arts and crafts, gifts, heirlooms, Southwest food, and more. Like, they even have beauty products on there too.
That's awesome.
And all of the proceeds go to support their nonprofit mission, which enables them to distribute seeds for free to Native American families. If you're a Native American family, you can contact them for free seeds. And also to their local community gardens, which is really...
Oh, that's so great.
Really stinking cool. And
yeah.
If you aren't local or a Native American family, you can also participate and support them by becoming a member, or you can even make just a single donation.
That's great.
Yeah. And then you can find them at nativeseeds.org. And actually how I found them was through our research, and we'll talk about them again a little bit later, but they have a lot more information on their website than just buying stuff too. So check them out.
Yeah. So definitely check them out. Again, we'll have those in our Instagram stories and our Facebook stories. So follow us. If you want to ask us a question, you can reach out to us on Instagram or email us at milkmaidspodcast@gmail.com. Please, please, please leave a review on iTunes. And we are looking for shout outs to give. So if you know somebody, let us know and we can feature them. And yeah, also, like, We are doing really well in rankings, especially in Belgium for some reason.
It's like,
hi,
always,
Belgium listeners.
Always like some foreign country that we're high ranking in, which I think is so cool. I don't really know how or why that happens, but.
Yeah. And actually, like the way you have to do a podcast when you give it a category, the categories are super random.
Yeah. And we don't fit well into one.
None of them.
Yeah.
None of them. Like how to, not really. I don't know. So I just chose like home and garden.
Yeah.
Because I felt like that was more of something that we could get into.
Yeah.
And we are like ranking even in the US, like in the hundreds, which is phenomenal for a podcast. Podcast, there's like a dime a dozen.
Right.
So I guess we're pretty cool. But leave us reviews because there's
podcasts. Pretty cool.
I guess we're pretty cool.
The way you said that.
I get so stoked because our downloads are crazy, like astronomical. But then we only have a couple reviews. So like, I don't know. I was terrible at leaving reviews before, but I get it. But other people can't find us if you don't review us.
Right.
So thank you.
And we're pretty cool.
Everyone who has reviewed. Yeah, we're pretty cool. I mean, Belgium thinks so.
Give us a review.
Belgium likes us.
Oh my gosh.
If you live in Belgium, please review us. Thank you. So did you see the icebreaker?
Yeah. I mean, like, as I was pulling this up to record, yes, but I did see it.
So what is something you want to learn more about this year?
So, well, it's interesting that we're talking about what we're talking about today, because it really is kind of what I want to learn more about. Oddly enough, was it like a week ago? I sent you a message about it just because it kind of freaked me out, but he's got the hiccups now. So
yes,
this is good.
Hold on, people.
Baby has the hiccups. They reported that the... river basin snowpack, trying to figure out how to say it without revealing my location. Anyhow, the snowpack report for the river basin closest to us is at an all-time low, like century low, which freaks me out. Last year we really struggled with water, and this year it's looking like we're really going to struggle with water, which we live in an area that doesn't necessarily struggle with water as a typical
Right. This is new.
Yeah. We don't live in the arid Southwest, right?
No.
I was like, man. And, you know, you look at the trends, right? And like the West is just, we're just in a drought in general. Like I said, we usually live in a isolated pocket, but I was talking with Brian about it when I read that. I was like, you know what? We have an amazing 100% free source of water here to our homestead property.
Yeah.
It's a gravity fed spring. We pay $0 for this.
Right.
Water. Like, we are incredibly blessed with free water and we typically don't have to worry about it. But what if we did? And then just because it's free doesn't mean that we shouldn't conserve it anyways. So all of that is to say water has been on my mind lately, and our garden, as we have done it in years past, has put 0% focus on conserving water.
Yeah.
0%.
Right. Cause it's never been an issue.
No. Like, we have zero mulch down. I mean, just like horrible as far as conserving water goes. So I think that this year, that might be something I try and learn a little bit more about, is how to conserve water better, how to help my garden use less in general.
Yeah.
Which ties in nicely to our topic today, which, as I was reading through and learning, I was like, you know, not too hard to do, really. Just need to take the steps to do it. It's one of those things. Sometimes when you don't face adversity, you don't grow. And we have not faced water adversity, so...
Right.
Going to try and get to it beforehand.
Yeah. And adapting is always good.
Yeah.
Like adapting to things. I mean, obviously, like some things you don't want to have to adapt to, but it's good to have that knowledge. Like I always think, okay, this has happened, so I can overcome this. And if it happens in the future, like I've got this.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
That's good.
How about you? Yeah.
Well, mine's kind of silly now. I want to learn how to like preserve more herbs.
Yeah.
To use throughout the year.
Yeah.
And even... skin herbs, like something I would use for skin, not just like tinctures or anything like that, just like herbs that I could use to infuse.
Yeah, totally.
Or make colors with. I'm kind of into that now.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's my hyper focus.
Heck yeah. I love that.
Yeah.
Have you found any good books on it yet?
No.
I know you're going to start looking.
Right. No, I have a lot of books. And actually, the idea of like dyeing with plants is really fascinating to me, because that used to be a whole ass art. Like, people just specialized in that prior to synthetic dye. So it'd be cool to just research that more. But have I got there yet? No. It's just an idea in my head.
I am, as we speak, pulling up our episode idea and writing down plant dyes.
You're welcome.
That's great. Plant dying.
Yeah.
No, because
It's better than aquaponies.
Aquaponies. Hey, try and top aquaponies. I dare you.
Underwater ponies.
Plant dying. Done.
That's a good one.
Okay. Come in your direction.
We've actually filled out that list for season 3, like a ridiculous amount now because of things we talk about on the podcast.
Just like this. But here's the thing. If I don't, in the moment, while we're recording, write it down, it will be lost forever.
Right. Forever.
Yep.
So.
What's happening?
What about farm updates for you?
Farm updates for me. My farm updates are getting just sillier and sillier as this whole maternity, post-maternity thing happens. Cleaning out my freezers, which is like always the only thing that I do, really.
Right.
I had bought bags of fruit at some point when they were on sale. God only knows when, right? For smoothies or whatever. So I had this bag of strawberries. It kept falling out of the freezer kind of thing. It's like, this has to go somewhere. So in sheer desperation just to put it somewhere, I decided to freeze dry them because that's just like a real easy way to put them somewhere, right? So they don't go to waste. So I ended up thawing them, pureeing them in my blender, and then freeze drying them, which gave me a powdered strawberry, right? Why in the hell would anybody want a powdered strawberry?
Yeah, that's what I'm wondering.
So the Melt Cow Kitchen book that we've talked about.
Oh. Right.
So it's a cookbook, also kind of a dairy cow how-to book.
Yeah, it's like everything rolled in one. Yeah. And it's expensive.
Yeah.
But there's a reason it's expensive.
Yeah, it's a great little book.
It has everything in it.
Yeah, everything from milking to like recipes and stuff. So anyhow, her name's Mary Jane Butters, but one of her recipes in there is a chocolate syrup for making chocolate milk. I've made that chocolate syrup recipe, and we make chocolate milk with it, and it's fantastic. We adore that recipe. Right under that is a recipe for strawberry milk.
That makes sense.
Which calls for powdered strawberries, which normally you would buy in like the preparedness section of your grocery store, right?
I've just never even heard of it, but that makes sense that it's a thing.
Yeah. Yes, but my stubborn ass is not going to go buy it. I'm going to make it. buy the freeze dryer. Buy the strawberries. Freeze dry the strawberries.
Right. So the steps to get one thing in our lives is never easy. Right.
Make the strawberry syrup.
Yep.
Go milk the whole ass cow. Mix them together.
Right.
And you have just spent thousands of dollars, countless hours to
a glass of strawberry milk.
Glass of strawberry milk.
You know what? I bet it's the best damn cup of strawberry milk
to ever exist. I don't even like strawberry milk.
What?
Well, it's fine. I don't dislike it. It's not like I drink it. I'm like, gross. But it's definitely way down there on my choice of beverages.
See, I like strawberry milk. I don't like chocolate milk.
Oh, you don't like chocolate because you're a weirdo. You're allergic or you don't like it.
No, I'm slightly like I'm not deathly allergic, but I am allergic. If I rub any cocoa butter on me, I break out in hives.
Right.
And if I eat chocolate, then I have like a headache the rest of the day.
Right. So that excuses you. You're not a total weirdo. I'm sorry.
Thank you. Right.
I really am sorry you have an allergy to chocolate because that sounds
like
a death sentence.
I don't like it anyway. So.
Well, probably because it makes you feel awful. You're wired to not like chocolates.
I do like strawberry. Like strawberry milk sounds banging. So.
Yeah. Well. Thousands of dollars, countless hours. I can make you some strawberry milk.
Well, does your toddler like it?
Yes, but this is going to come as no surprise to anybody. When you make this strawberry syrup with like just regular ingredients, right, and put it in the milk, it doesn't make bright pink milk, right?
Oh,
weird.
Yeah.
So I wanted to make it fun and exciting, and so I put a couple drops of red food coloring to make it that bright pink.
Right.
And I thought she is going to lose her mind when she sees this pink milk. And she tasted it and was like, good, Mom. And like, that was it.
Oh,
she hasn't asked for more.
That's
heartbreaking. Yeah, it wasn't like a big, right. So thousands of dollars and countless hours for your toddler to be like, it's okay.
Yeah. I take it or leave it. It's okay. It's fine.
Here's the thing. I had to do something with those strawberries. And I probably still will continue to make strawberry milk. Again, I like it. It's just not my number one.
Right.
I don't crave strawberry milk, right?
Yeah.
Well, so I could bake with that powder or make yogurt or whatever, right? It's not going to go to waste, but yeah, that's like my funny. But like, if that doesn't sum up homesteading, I don't know what does.
Why buy a $4 canister of Nesquik when you could literally spend $3,000 plus on the equipment to make strawberry milk?
Right.
Right.
Yeah. So, and then speaking of strawberries, I bought 100 strawberry plants.
Holy cow.
Because normal. Normal.
What else do you do?
Well, the strawberry plants we have, we love them, but they're everbearing. So we, yeah. like, we don't preserve a single strawberry. We just snack them out of the garden when we're out there.
That's the problem.
A couple available, you know, every day or whatever. So
did you get June bearing then?
Yeah. And we actually got like a later season bearing. I mean, they're technically called a June bearing, but they'll be more like July or August here probably.
Yeah. Yeah. For you.
But they're a northern climate favorite. I'm excited about them. But it was that thing where you could buy 25, which is a completely reasonable number of strawberry plants.
And you're like, absolutely not. I am not a reasonable human.
But for like $6 more, you could get 100 of them, right?
Right. So why not get 100?
Like, come on. It's science. So anyways, if anybody needs strawberry plants, let me know.
If you're in the Wyoming area.
I got you some strawberry plants. So yes, my week has been very strawberry.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It is very strawberry themed. So on my end, milk issue, I don't know what's going on. Labs came back great. Excellent. All of the labs did.
Yeah. Yeah. Because I think last time we talked, the lab had just received them.
Yeah. 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 So all the labs came back. SCC, SPC, total coliform, all looked good. Standard plate count, everything. Fine.
Fine.
I already said that. Fine. But then again, like, her milk tastes weird still. So I don't know what's happening. And then 3/4 of it is cream.
Yeah.
No joke. And I'm getting a gallon, so I don't know what's going on there. And then I'll have like these little clumps that I have no clue what they are, because she does not have mastitis.
Right.
She's been lab tested, and she's also getting a CMT daily. Like, I test her daily.
Right.
Because I just have no idea what's going on. So I just think maybe it's just her cycle ending. But
so weird.
She can't end because she's over-conditioned. So I'm still milking her and like experimenting with the milk. But right now we're all off of raw milk. So our bodies are adjusting. And then giving it all to the pigs, which is good because I have piglets and nursing moms who need the calories. Not a huge loss. Like, that's the best thing about having pigs.
Not a loss at all.
It's not a loss at all, especially with the prices of grain right now.
Yeah.
And I can get those piglets really bulked up. So I love that. But yeah, that's about all that's going on my farm.
Are the all of the piglets back to normal now from the greasy pig situation?
Yeah.
Everybody's good.
Yeah. It's kind of interesting how that worked out. Like, if you catch it early enough, you can't even really tell that they had a problem.
Yeah.
But most people
wait
way too long, where it covers their whole body and then they likely die. Because it gets in their blood.
Yeah.
It can get in their blood. That's what happens.
Yeah.
When that staph gets in your blood.
Staph in your blood is not cool. I've had it twice.
Yeah. Oh my God. Uh-huh. That's right. You were telling me that.
Yeah. I moved to Colorado. Really, it tried to kill me.
Right. It's really aggressive. But if you catch it early, not so aggressive. And pigs are amazing. Like, they'll just live through pretty much anything. So
yeah.
Catch it early, you'll be fine. Anyway, what are we talking about today?
Well, today's this episode is such a train wreck.
Well, it's milkmaids at night.
Right. No one's surprised at this point. So the concept here, Tara and I sat down last summer and wrote out a schedule.
Yeah.
Just rattling off some topic ideas, right? And what was written on the schedule was monoculture versus permaculture, right? Should not be that hard.
That was my idea.
It's not. Right. Why did I do it? It's not that hard. This is not that hard. But my ADHD overtired ass.
Right.
Took this and complicated it to the T, which, again, who's surprised? So anyhow, as the research progressed, this is less of a monoculture versus permaculture and more of a what is monoculture, what is permaculture, and how you can use it.
Right.
So a combination of what stuff is and a how to.
Yeah.
I have no idea what's happening. I just followed it. This is inside my ADHD brain.
See, that's a thing. When you start researching, you just kind of got to follow where it takes you. It's fine. Right. This is fine. Please review us, because clearly we are doing an excellent job.
We have it together.
We have it together.
Maybe listen to next week's episode and then think about leaving us a review, actually.
So hold off on the reviews. Just kidding. God. Do you want to take it?
Sure. Starting off, we're going to talk about monoculture. And monoculture is something that, like, maybe you haven't heard that exact term, but you know what it is. So monoculture is defined as the cultivation of a single crop in a given area. So like an entire field planted in corn and only corn, for example. This is...
Yeah, soy and corn are the first two things that people think of when you're thinking of monoculture.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
But there's millions of different crops that can be monocultured.
And if it grows, it can be monocultured.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, so like row cropping is another.
Yeah.
Monoculture is what we in America typically think of, though, as farming. And right. Think of the flyover states. When you're flying over them, there's pattern, quilt work pattern.
That term,
right? Where the land will be in squares and circles. And that is how those things are planted and irrigated, respectfully. So
I love that. I actually really like looking at that. I think it's cool.
Oh, it's gorgeous.
Yeah, it really is.
If you don't know the rest of the story, but
looking at it, it's visibly pleasing.
Yeah.
Kind of like lawns.
Right.
In a way. I don't like lawns, but you know, like there is something nice about, could you imagine not having animals or a garden and just mowing your lawn every other week? Like.
Sounds delightful.
Right. Sometimes that just sounds nice.
Sometimes it does sound nice.
Right. Right. Having a garage door that works, you know.
Right.
Kind of thing. Right.
It's your biggest problem. So we do monoculture on large scales because there's a lot of significant advantages to it. So you get really high yields. Everything gets the same exact treatment, which leads to more production and lower costs. Also better earnings in sort of a similar vein there is that only one method's needed here, right? So you only have to spend time researching one way, which less time is more money. And also... Right. Only one type of equipment is needed. That's a slight oversimplification, but you're going to get a series of equipment that's going to do the entire job start to finish, right?
Right. So like if you're a potato farmer, you get the specific $2 million machine that digs up potatoes.
Right.
Right.
If you're a corn farmer, you get the corn harvester. Same.
Soybean harvester.
Right. It's a, you buy these things, you will be successful. So, right, the equipment is designed for the specific thing that's growing, and everything is automated in that way, which, again, is less time and labor, which equals a higher payout. And there's a sort of simplicity to monocrop growing monoculture. So what I mean by that is there's a strict plan, right? It's easy to follow. You till, you plant, you spray, fertilize, harvest, repeat, right? And this is kind of exaggerated and silly, but there's something to be said for having a step-by-step plan that works every time. And
yeah,
my type A brain can really dig in and enjoy that sort of process. Yeah.
Right.
And you do have a reduced amount of additional land needed. And this is kind of a complicated thing to explain at this point, but synthetic fertilizers make it to where you can get more done on less land. And getting into the synthetic fertilizers, now we start the list of disadvantages to monoculture. So when you're doing monoculture, you have to use harmful chemical products. There's no way around it.
No.
Planting a single crop removes a specific set of nutrients from the soil. And fertilizers. It's like a lot of extra G's in there for some reason.
So G heavy. Right?
Fertilizers are used as a response to this. Pesticides and herbicides are also in heavy use. And by tilling and planting only one crop, there's no natural protection from either weeds or pests.
Right.
And again, kind of going hand in hand with that, water contamination is a big issue. So first off, who wants to eat food with all those chemical residues on them? That's disgusting. But perhaps a larger scope issue here is that these chemicals are being sprayed without selection, meaning they're not just sprayed on that one weed. They're sprayed throughout the entire field, which results in a wild overuse. And the extra chemicals absolutely make their way into the soil, into our water sources, into rivers, streams, lakes, all of that, which affect both our drinking water and water habitat.
Yes. And that affects everything that lives in it.
Right. Which, as we know, water ecosystems they're wildly important. So the chemicals are damaging our ecosystems way outside of that single field of corn, for example. You can look at a field of corn, especially when it's not in use, it's literally a field of dirt. And you can see that there's no ecosystem there.
No, none.
But it's not the damage is not isolated to just that. So speaking of that field of dirt, soil degradation and erosion are both massive concerns as well. And to fully understand this, we should probably have done an episode on soil and soil health, because soil is a wonderfully diverse living substance with so many components to be affected. The use of chemical fertilizers, herbicides, and pesticides damages these microorganisms in the soil. And then when the crops are harvested, there's nothing there to hold the soil together to prevent erosion. And when the soil is dead and exposed, the topsoil is very likely to later days write off those fields, like gone.
Bye.
So, which then continues the cycle, right? Like you're losing any benefit, any nutrients right. you had. So then you spray more. So then you lose more. So then you spray more, right? So now the farmer, right, just has to keep going. And it's kind of a vicious cycle.
Or once you start, it's really hard to stop.
Right.
And you have to think of like the Dust Bowl. There's a lot of evidence that humans caused that.
Right.
Obviously, like we know that now. It can happen now.
Yes.
Right? So.
Yeah. And most likely will.
Right. So polyculture. Polyculture is growing more than one variety in a given area. It is designed to mimic nature by planting species that complement each other and work together. Plants all have innate qualities that contribute to the greater ecosystem around them, and some are great at detouring weeds and pests. Others are great at attracting beneficial pollinators, and some help improve the soil. And there are a ton of reasons to have plants do the work for you. And polyculture is very easy and practical in a home garden where you're wanting a varied harvest for your family.
Your family is not going to only eat tomatoes.
Right. As much as you like a good juicy tomato, like planting only tomatoes is not
right.
the way to go.
Yeah. Most of us on the house garden scale are naturally doing a polyculture anyhow.
So good for you. That's great.
Right. We're doing the thing.
We're doing the thing. In terms of larger scale farming, the term intercropping is often used, and this is where altering rows of different crops are grown, sort of a compromise between mono and polyculture to capitalize on the best of both practices. And in terms of advantages and disadvantages, really you just flip the monoculture and that's your advantages for polyculture. So advantages are resistant to pests naturally, so you're not spraying the entire time. Better soil quality, biodiversity, and suppression of weeds. But the disadvantages are labor intensive. So this is more labor intensive because you can't just buy one machine that does it all on a large scale.
Correct.
And a lot more time learning about methods and multiple different plants is required. And it requires so much more observation and accommodation compared to monoculture, which follows a specific pathway. Like there's literal college classes you can take on soybeans and how to produce soybeans in a monoculture way. Much like how knowledge out there applies to Cornish cross, if you're raising meat birds, the same is true with crops. Most knowledge out there is developed for monoculture practices. So if you go get an ag degree, you're going to learn about monoculture. They'll probably mention polyculture, but most of it is focused on monoculture because that's what's most practiced. So knowing these parts and pieces, that's on you, and meaning you have to figure it out kind of on the fly.
Totally. And then, so like a brief pivot to permaculture, and then the rest is going to be muddied.
But can you tell two ADHD women wrote this?
This is insane, right? This is like ping pong balls. So I'm willing to bet that most everyone has heard the term monoculture and permaculture, yet somehow the term polyculture is frequently left out. And that's kind of because monoculture and permaculture are really the most extreme ends of the spectrum. So monoculture is doing the least, whereas permaculture is truly doing the most, right?
It's the most.
So it's absolutely the most. Permaculture is a type of polyculture. Remember, polyculture just means more than one plant, right? But permaculture has a much bigger scope. Permaculture goes like a giant step further in that it is polyculture while also considering larger aspects of the farm ecosystems such as water, energy sources, building, shelter, shade, etc. When you're looking at polyculture, you're going to look at where your barn is built, for example. Like that sounds ridiculous.
On the property.
Right.
Like every single thing is considered.
Yes, exactly.
Yes.
And how it all works together. So as a general rule of thumb, permaculture tends to work heavily with perennials, whereas the term polyculture is typically thought of as annuals. These are just generalizations though, and typically what is thought of in everyday conversation as opposed to an actual definition. But so we just wanted to clear up like the little nuance lack of definition there, lack or support of definition maybe. So they're kind of the same and they're kind of different. So that's where the rest of this episode, some things will be strictly permaculture, some things are polyculture. And you know what? It doesn't entirely matter which category they fall into.
How can you incorporate polyculture and permaculture into your own space? there is the option of a 7-layer food forest. And the idea of a food forest is more of a permaculture concept modeled from real forests. And the design and thought is that every forest has layers that contribute and capitalize off of specific niches inside of itself. And this leads to an overall increased diversity of life and the ecosystem. And every component in the system should be food producing. So when we are talking about trees, we mean fruit and nut trees. And when we are talking about shrubs, we mean berries. So when designing this type of garden, there are 7 layers to consider. Number 1 is the canopy layer. This is the starting point of the design, considering they are the largest pieces. Pick full size, so like over 30 feet ideally, fruit and nut trees. And this isn't something that just grows overnight. So you're really thinking of the long haul here, not just about you, but like the future humans that may live there.
Yes. And that's like, yeah, that's huge with this one, especially, or with permaculture in general, obviously. But like, I think one of the most beautiful things is that you've heard of that, like, I don't know if it's a saying or whatever, but
about the trees.
Yeah. And how does it go? It's like the most beautiful thing is planting a tree in whose shade you know you'll never stand under.
Yes.
Something like that, right?
Right.
Right. Because there's something about, and I don't know if it's like the tree of life sort of concept, but there's something about a tree that bridges generational.
Like your grandfather could plant that tree.
Yeah.
And his grandson is sitting on it, who he's never met, right?
Yeah. There's something so romantic about trees in that way.
Yes. Yes, that's very true. So number 2 would be the sub-canopy layer, and these trees will be the bulk of your fruit as they will be the easiest to harvest. And don't forget species of coffee or olive trees if your climate allows. So I guess Wyoming is not allowing that for you, unfortunately. I would love to have some olive trees.
I can't even do nut trees. You might be able to grow olive trees. Have you looked?
No,
they grow
I haven't.
Them in Oregon.
Okay. Maybe I will look because...
You'd have to find an extreme... one probably. Yeah, Oregon's quite a bit probably. Warmer than you, but not by a ton.
No.
Maybe. I don't know.
I really want an olive tree. Now, that's my hyper focus.
Right.
Oh, good. Number 3 would be the shrub layer, and this is up to 10 feet high. These can be fruit, flowering, or medicinal shrubs. Like Siberian pea shrubs or blueberries are good options. Number 4 is the herbaceous layer, and this layer usually dies off every winter and gives it back to the environment around it. And this layer can be anything from small bushes to herbs. Number 5, the ground cover layer. This layer is frequently overlapped. This layer is frequently overlapped with the herbaceous layer, and these plants are horizontal growers that are also shade tolerant. Legume species are great options here. And then number 6, your underground layer. So this is root crops that are very common for this layer, but it can really be a number of things. And this is an important layer as it provides pathways for water and air to enter the soil. A lot of times they'll tell you to plant radishes next to things if you have hard soil.
Yeah. Daikon radishes in particular because they grow so long.
Right. Yes. Yes. And they do really help out. And then number 7 would be your vertical climber layer. And this layer is anything that climbs. Beans, obviously, are the first that come to mind, or climbing spinach. I think climbing spinach is like so rad.
I put that in there just for you because you're the one who told me about climbing spinach.
I think it's so cool.
Have you grown any yet?
No, I just remembered it when you put this in there. So I think I'm going to have to get some.
Yeah.
I did order from Kitazawa Seeds.
Did you?
Like, I got a huge order from them, but I forgot to look for that. So I have to get it from Indigenous Seed Initiative.
Is that where it was? I remember us talking about it in a shout out. I can't remember who.
It was our very first episode.
Was it really?
Yes.
Perfect.
Yes. Perfect. Circle back, right? And these plants are really cool because they utilize taller plants to gather their sunlight. So bonus layer, number 8, your aquatic layer. And if you're lucky enough to have water in your food garden, there's a whole new level of aquatic plants that can be incorporated. And the even nicer part is that you can pair it with some fish or prawns, something like that. You also have another bonus layer, your fungal layer, which is probably my favorite. It's not usually included, but why not, right?
Right.
And fungi is wildly important to ecosystems and can also provide a great source of nutrition. There's these people local to me that have a dugout basement, like a old kind of basement.
Uh-huh.
And they took buckets and they're growing mushrooms in that basement.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And you hardly need anything to grow these mushrooms. It's so easy. Who knew?
We need to get on it because my one goal this winter was to get one of those on the counter box mushroom grower, and I never did do it.
Does Brian eat mushrooms?
Yeah, and he wants to try that mushroom growing thing too. We're gonna have to do it. I keep saying we're out of winter, but we have feats of snow, and it is actively snowing. So
it's literally winter right there all the time. It's
literally still winter. So
okay,
gosh, so. Guilds is the next thing we're going to talk about. That seven-layer forest sounds amazing, yeah, but it's also, like, from my perspective, super intimidating. Sounds like a lot of work and a lot of time invested, right? So another way to start is, and maybe build up experience to tackle a food forest, is by building a guild. And guilds can really be anything as far as space, components, and overall scope. But this is why they're great. And they can be carried out in something even as like a small raised bed. You could technically even do a guild in a container to some degree.
Yes.
But the idea of a guild is to try and incorporate some levels of the seven layer forest into a space and look at which plants work together and which and how they provide different things, right? So your best friend on this front is a companion planting book or chart or guide.
Yes.
There's lots of free online options. Keep in mind that this is only one component though. People get too locked into these charts, I feel like. But it is a great jumping off point. So ultimately, really, we are looking for plants that will work well together. And then to take it a step further in term of a guild, we're looking for a larger picture though than just plant friends. We want to look for how they work together to build their own ecosystem. And one example that most of us are probably familiar with, we've mentioned it on the show. I have no idea what episode that was, but the Three Sisters Method.
Yes. So the Three Sisters Method is one great example of polyculture that makes it really easy to understand. And don't get locked into this. It's just a really good example.
Yeah. And that's like the rest of the episode is seriously going to be just examples because for me, that helped me understand it better, was just reading a bunch of examples.
Right. It's a jumping off point. And this method was utilized by indigenous people, and we can learn a lot from it today. The three sisters included corn, beans, and squash, and each benefited the other in a different way. So corn is tall and provides a support for the beans to grow up. The beans fix nitrogen in the soil to be used by the other plants. And the squash creates a ground cover that suppresses weeds and pests, as well as prevents evaporation, and therefore conserves water for all three plants. This example is the best to learn about what polyculture is because it does demonstrate so clearly how each plant is helping each other. So my personal favorite, thanks for writing this, is chaos gardening. I'm a chaos gardener. Steph is not.
I cannot. It makes me twitch.
Does it bother you when you come into my garden?
I love being in your garden.
Okay.
Because it is so relaxing. Yeah. I imagine people walking into my garden being like, oh gosh, I better not sneeze or I'll mess something up.
Yeah, I don't garden that way. No. I love that for
I
you.
I hate that for me. I love it for you. It's like I am so type A, it hurts in the garden and I'm going to work Aries on that vibes. This year. Aries, I 100% am. You will live in this row and you're going to like it.
Wait, what's your moon sign? I forgot.
Taurus. Which doesn't make a ton of sense. I mean, it kind of does once you know me a little bit better, but...
Right. You are bullheaded.
Right. So I love being in your garden. It would take me, I feel like, years to figure out how to plant your garden because there's no specific plan and I would lose sleep over that.
Yeah. Chaos gardening's fun. I'm just doing it for the earth, really.
Yeah. But like, it sounds... The whole thing sounds relaxing. I just...
So yeah, you just plant corn, beans, and squash. Boom, done. But then there's Stephanie.
Right, and I just can't. I have to know exactly how to do things.
Right. Which you can still apply some of that knowledge to how Stephanie does her garden, right?
Well, technically mine is a polyculture.
It is.
It's just not a permaculture.
Right.
Right.
So you want to make sure that you are planting in order that they are given time to mature at the appropriate time. So... Like my sunflowers, I'll have this problem. So I have to really think about it. Like my sunflowers, I'll plant them kind of near where shade, things that like shade are going to be in front. So you just have to think of like what grows really fast and is tall and then plant accordingly because you can absolutely use that to your advantage. Like some things like spinach like shade. So you can plant them behind where your sun hits the sunflowers and doesn't hit the spinach as much. And just start with planting the corn first. You want the corn its tallest first. And then 2 to 3 weeks later, you want to plant your pole beans or when the corn is a few inches tall. That way, when the beans get to the point of producing their tendrils, the corn will be tall enough and strong enough to support them, because you don't want the corn to be choked out by the beans. And then plant the squash 1 week after the beans have emerged, and don't rush the squash because their leaves will shade out the other plants if you plant too early. And, you know, if you don't get it right the first time, guess what? You just learned. That's a learning time for you. And then the other thing that gets some of us is the need for layout, Stephanie.
Right. I have to know. And that's the thing. Like what you were saying just then is like, there's going to be another year figured out then. I have, that is one thing that gardening has taught me. Yeah. And has helped me with my mental health issues as far as if you don't hit it out of the park this time, it's okay.
Yeah.
It is okay. And actually,
it really, I get really stoked because I'm like, I know what I did to mess this up. Yeah. But next year, I'm not going to make that mistake.
Right.
So right. It's kind of empowering.
Yeah, no, it is. Especially when you look at it that way. As opposed to, I think every spring I'm just going to be a giant failure. Like, I get so like perfectionist on it, and it does not have to be that way.
Spring can be intimidating because right. there's so much to do. So don't let it overtake you.
Right.
And there are several options online for layout plans if you're interested. And we'll be linking the Native Seeds website, and they have specific info on it. And the biggest thing to consider with layout is that you need enough corn to effectively pollinate. And corn pollinates via wind, which is so cool. Like grasses do the same thing. You need a block of corn, ideally 4 rows wide in the traditional sense. They don't have to be in true rows.
So another example of a guild then, and this example, I'm not taking credit for, it comes from permaculturenews.org, which we'll have linked in the show notes. But find 2 plants that are great companions, say carrots and onions, and start there. So that covers the underground layer of the forest. Now, what about weed suppression? So both carrots and onions grow well with lettuce. So lettuce will also help retain the moisture by preventing evaporation. And this would cover the ground cover level of the forest. For the vertical layer, then you could do peas, which would be a great option as they also add nitrogen to the soil. Peas, however, do not much care for onions. But they grow really good with carrots. So just arrange them in a way that makes sense there. And then what about pests? How about a rosemary plant? Strong smelling herbs usually repel pests. And in this case, rosemary could be the centerpiece or the tiny little canopy layer for this microforest guild that we're building right here. Also, rosemary is in most areas, not here, a perennial plant. So that helps with your soil structure as well. So that's just like a really cute little example. Rosemary, carrots, onions, peas, lettuce, done. You could do that in a container.
Yeah, on a small scale too.
Yeah.
And here's another example of a guild. What's at the center? For this example, we're choosing tomatoes as a main star crop. They're the star. And we'll build everything else around that. So tomato is a good choice because it's relatively large as a plant and also something we all grow and use. So what's repelling pests? Basil is a great choice because it has a strong scent that does repel pests. And it also pairs well in the kitchen with tomatoes, and harvesting is such a breeze. Oh, now I'm really craving tomatoes with mozzarella and basil. Thank you.
Sounds so good.
It does. What's protecting the soil then? Nasturtiums are a great choice with tomatoes. They are a spreading plant that will offer mulch to the soil. As an added benefit, nasturtiums are edible. Both the flowers and leaves and seeds even. Because it's flowers, it will also attract pollinators to help give you even more tomatoes. But what's fertilizing the soil? The typical go-to is legumes, but tomatoes don't much care for them. So we will choose borage instead. And this plant pulls up trace minerals and fertility through its long taproot. And borage is great at repelling tomato worms. It is said to improve the flavor of a tomato as well, and the beautiful purple flowers attract even more pollinators. It's a large plant that will also suppress leaves, and its leaves and flowers are edible, and it has medicinal properties. It's self-seeding, and this episode is absolutely sponsored by Borage.
The more I wrote that, the more I'm like...
Borage is a star.
I'm buying Borage seeds now. Have you ever grown Borage?
Yeah.
Yeah, I have... I had 3 or 4 plants out there last year. I'm curious if they're going to self-seed.
Yeah.
But it's a great plant.
You'll have to let me know. It is. It really is. So what about the underground layer? So garlic would be amazing here. Again, garlic and tomatoes pair well in the kitchen too, so that's an added bonus. And you can also grow garlic as a perennial, which means even more hands-off. All you have to do is leave the bulbs in the ground, and they will continue to produce more and more garlic plants, and you can eat all the shoots as green garlic, which has a more mild taste. I love this person made like pesto with garlic shoots.
Garlic scapes.
And you put it on a burger like a homemade bun. Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh. My kids just got to get you to
freaking grow garlic.
I'm over it. I swear to God.
I'm going to plan my fall around planting garlic at your house.
I drive Stephanie crazy. It is
the most ridiculous thing that you do. Or don't do, actually.
I opt out.
You know how easy it is to grow garlic.
I know. And I love it too. That's what's bothersome. I'm problematic, really.
Really?
I am.
It really just gets me going, this whole garlic situation.
She's over me. Good. What's staying to protect the structure of the soil? A perennial is a great option, and in this case, we choose asparagus. Asparagus takes years to establish and harvest. Planting it in this type of guild is a great option because the space is still productive while you wait on asparagus. And asparagus is also a great companion to tomatoes. I actually didn't know that.
About the companion part of it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't either.
Wow.
People always talk about asparagus and strawberries together.
Yeah.
But yeah, I didn't know that about asparagus and tomatoes. They like each other.
So overall, this example is a great, relatively hands-off example of what you can grow. Garlic, basil, and asparagus are perennials, and borage, nasturtium, and tomatoes are all great self-seeders. That means that in theory, once planted, the guild will sustain itself with very little input. And this is the ultimate goal. Lots of food for little effort, and nature handles itself.
I think I may seriously try that guild.
It's like yeah.
Yeah, like that entire, what you just read, that entire setup exactly to the T in a small spot.
It's a good one.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is a really good one.
Yeah, I'm kind of excited about that. My problem is I absolutely have to grow tomatoes in the greenhouse.
Yeah.
Because they will not live out here without a greenhouse.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
My only hesitation on that is it's a little nerve-wracking setting up something permanent in a greenhouse, but why not?
Right. Nobody's stopping.
Yeah. Me. So anyways, I think with scaling back, we're gonna have a lot more room in the greenhouse, and I think I may try it in a designated area anyhow. I want to just offer this reminder about the Permaculture Women's Guild. We did a shout out for them a couple weeks ago. But this episode obviously calls us to bring them up again. So we just want to remind you guys too that they do offer free courses on permaculture, and like massively impressive free courses. This is not just like a 15-minute video.
No.
Right.
Right. No, it's very good, mm-hmm. and well put together.
Yes.
And much, like, we cannot even do justice to what it is.
No, and that's not what our
podcast is about.
No, our podcast is strictly a jumping pad for people.
Yeah.
At this point, anyways, years down the road, when we've covered everything there is to cover, then we'll be there. But we wanted to remind you of that. And then one feature that I found on their website, too, that I hadn't found the first time around was that, like, so we went over some, like, really quick and easy, very simple on the surface examples, right? Nothing we covered was too over the top.
No.
But there's definitely more to know and so many more intricate details to a full-blown permaculture plan. Like we said, if you're going to do it really, really good, you need to be considering like where your buildings are on your property. So if you want to look at what this would look like to do a full plan, follow the link in our show notes. But on the Permaculture Women's Guild, there's a section. So in order for their students to earn the permaculture design certificate, they have to create an entire system and then do a presentation on that, right? And they post all of these to their website so you can see it. And it's,
oh wow, that's amazing.
It's really, really cool. I was looking at them today, and like all that goes into a full-blown plan is super impressive. Like these people are talking about like microclimates and shade and like typical, like they have wild rabbits and these are the tracks that the rabbits usually follow. Like,
wow.
All of, yeah, these like sort of things that you could go and look further into. But also another kind of fun aspect of it, like it's fun just to look at that. Another fun aspect of this is that you can see where the students are, relatively speaking. Like, this one's in North Carolina, this one's in Colorado. Right.
So you can have an example locally to you.
Yeah. And one of the students was in an area of Colorado that sort of mimics where we are, high country and cold and dry and whatever. So I was looking at hers because I was like, oh, I wonder what plant she did. And I was looking there and very similar to things that I'm aware of as to what grows well here. So anyhow, if you're kind of stuck, like, that might be a good place to look too. Like, if you're just not sure what plants to plant, see what their permaculture plan is. Maybe you can kind of piggyback off of that and find different guilds that would work well in different spaces of your property. So anyways, we just wanted to bring them up again. Go support them. Go participate. Yeah.
I saw that Tracy from Featherbeard Farms was really excited. I think she did sign up. So
did she?
Hopefully she'll update us on that.
Yeah, I would love to know, Tracy. As I was writing this out, I'm like, ooh, I should sign up for that. Because now I'm all excited about permaculture and stuff. But I really need to wait till winter to sign up to do it justice, because I've got a lot on my plate right now. But if you don't have so much on your plate, sign up and let us know. And we will be circling back to it as well, because now I'm all stoked on it. And I think I am going to try that one very specific example in my greenhouse.
Yeah, it would be cool to do like a science experiment, like kind of like the socks where I lost one. So I can't really update you on that, but...
You still haven't found yours?
I haven't found it, no.
Good.
It's lost.
My Darn Tough socks are doing great.
You like them.
They're doing great. Yeah, the only thing I don't care for them is I ordered a size smaller than I should have, but that's not their fault.
No.
That's my fault.
That's your fault. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You can take the blame.
I like baggy socks.
Who knew?
It's all niche. About that airspace, man.
I know. You're really obsessed with the
mittens
airspace.
Mittens and big socks.
Who knew?
Goodbye.
Get that put on a shirt.
Happy milking.
Happy milking. Happy permaculturing. Or polyculturing.
Go permapolyculture your garden.
Go chaos garden. We should turn that into a shirt. Oh, chaos gardener.
I'm gonna twitch.
You wouldn't be allowed to have one.
I'll just vibrate inside of it.
You're like, I'm really not a chaos. I'm a phony.
I'll order a straitjacket with mine.
Good.
Oh my god.
Excellent.
All right.
Well, this has been Milkmaids.
Milkmaids after dark. Happy milking.
We're fine. This is fine.
Everything's fine. Bye.